Welcome to The Science Line. I'm Scott.
And I'm Risa. We're here to learn about the science that's happening here in our Idaho community, but we're also challenging scientists who dare to come on our show to think about how they communicate their research to people who know nothing about it, but whose tax dollars are funding it, like us.
But we're not going to take it easy on our guests. They will have to pay for their communication faux pas, like using ridiculous and unrelatable science terms and jargon, and they better not bore us. Based on how well they do, we'll assign them written homework in the form of lines. Hopefully, this will remind them of their blunders and what not to do next time.
Geez, take it easy, Scott. No one's going to want to come on our show if you keep carrying on like that.
Risa, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Scott?
Yeah, really good.
Good. So I'm excited to be back with the Science Line today, and I'm wondering what communication topic we're going to kick the show off with this week.
This week, I want to talk about how science communication exists beyond just Western society.
That's such a good idea, because if you asked a science communicator how old their field is, they might say, a few decades or even centuries, but they would be wrong.
Yeah. Because when we think about science communication, we often just think about Western science communication. Yet we as human beings have obviously always communicated knowledge within our societies. In fact, there's even evidence of this going back tens of thousands of years.
Yeah, there are loads of examples of amazing engineering and scientific feats throughout history. In fact, I was just reading an article. It was called Three Reasons to Study Science Communication Beyond the West. Mm. This was published by The Conversation, and they publish articles by academics. And this article talked about how Persian engineers built ingenious constructions to provide things like water, air conditioning, and refrigeration to communities that were living in the desert. And this was thousands of years ago.
Wow. Yeah, so the question really is then, why are cultural and historical examples of science communication so readily ignored by modern Western society?
Yeah, you know, it really makes me wonder and think that the answer is probably pretty complicated.
Yeah, why is nothing ever easy?
Right? Well, as we consider how history is perpetuated, we have Winston Churchill that said, history is written by the victors. Mm. And the histories we learn about are to some extent political.
Yeah.
And political factors can determine, you know, key elements like where a story begins and ends.
Yeah, exactly. Or what's included or excluded. Yeah. And so when we're talking about political factors, we're not necessarily just talking about Democrats and Republicans, but we're really talking about where the power structures existed at that time and who was in control of the narrative. But yeah, to add to that, I was reading that influential 20th century scholars actually did a lot of work to define science. But they actually did it quite narrowly. So they gave a very narrow definition of what science was. And they actually just really focused on this Western version of knowledge production.
That's so interesting. And it seems like the problem with that is that the non-Western knowledge systems would be painted as lesser because they're excluded from the definition of science.
Yeah, exactly. But of course, this wasn't always the case. So I was reading as well the article you were talking about. In there, it talked about how European medical writers regularly used Arabic pseudonyms for their published work. And they did that because it demonstrated prestige. And this prestige existed because they were actually leaders in pharmaceuticals between the 9th and 13th century.
Wow, that's so awesome. Now, another example that was from this article that we both have read is the Maori culture, which is an indigenous tribal people from New Zealand. And they predate any European settlement in New Zealand. Now, some of the Maori stories teach of hydrological patterns in New Zealand and actually warn of where it is not safe to build houses.
Oh.
And their stories are based on knowledge that was gathered over time, which is really, really cool to think about, that they used their knowledge.
Just passed it down.
And passed it down.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the idea is that those stories and the knowledge that they passed down was then consistent with what Western scientists went in and measured. And that's really important because it demonstrates that actually there are different methodologies to deliver the same results.
Oh, I love what you just said, Scott. I think that's true. We don't have to do things the same. It doesn't mean one is better than the other, right? It's just like with cultures. I lived in China for a year, and our cultures are very different, but they're both beautiful in their own ways. And I think it's the same with science. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be done the exact way, you know, we do in Western culture, but you can actually get really similar results.
Yeah, you can still learn from different methodologies.
We need to be clear that we're not saying that Western science is wrong by any means. You know, Western science has delivered many important scientific breakthroughs, and its process of incremental improvement is improving our understanding of the world. But I think Western science needs to be more inclusive, and we need to recognize the contributions from other cultures and other societies that have really led us to where we are today.
Yeah, and by more inclusive, like you say, we're really talking about we need to understand and appreciate the value of what you could describe as alternative knowledge types. Mm-hmm. Of course, we see them as
Absolutely.
Alternative because we grew up and we understand this idea of Western knowledge generation.
Right.
But obviously these ideas would not be alternative if you grew up in another culture. But that's just the way we would describe
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
But yeah, for instance, here in Idaho, scientists are often keen to collaborate with tribal experts. And it's really great that they do this because it not just produces more equitable outcomes and considers tribal values and culture, but it actually contributes this different type of knowledge, which is actually really important to complement Western knowledge and actually leads to better, more positive outcomes for everybody.
Absolutely. I think that's really important. And as science communicators, we should be very deliberate in acknowledging alternative sources of knowledge.
Yeah, exactly.
This week on The Science Line, we are joined by Idaho State University anthropology professor, Dr. Kate Reedy. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
My understanding is that your PhD is in social anthropology. And so I'm wondering, at the most basic level, what is that?
That is the study of living peoples. All the things that we do and think about and even anticipate in the future.
Oh boy, this should be a fun conversation today, Scott.
Yeah, so Risa and I were actually just talking about different types of knowledge generation and scientific communication. So we were actually talking about how societies, other than just Western societies, so perhaps indigenous peoples are able to communicate science in a way that perhaps we don't recognize in Western society. So it sounds like you do a lot of work with indigenous communities. I wonder if you have any insight into how they perhaps would have communicated science in their communities.
Sure. I mean, I mostly work in Alaska, and the community that I work with is the Aleut population. They're also called Unangan. They were not literate until the Russians came and made them literate in Cyrillic and Russian. And so prehistorically, they would have been an oral society, so they would have just been a lot of discussion. And one of the things that they used to do with the kids is they would try to toughen them up. So they'd have them walk around on sharp rocks and on cold beaches and in cold water to try to get them strong to be able to withstand their own environment as adults.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting. Oh, I can't wait to hear more about your work with this group in Alaska. So before we ask you to tell us more about your work specifically, we always start the show off by finding out if our guest was well-behaved in school and if you ever had to write lines on the board.
Never. I was such a saint. I was so boring.
That's like me, Scott. That's like me. Yes, not like you. So we have two saints. And
I think you might be our first guest who never had to do any lines. Is that true?
No. Well, I think we've had one or two others, but never one that was a complete saint. I think that's the first.
So the reason we like to ask that is because here on The Science Line, we like to dish out lines at the end of the show. And the number of lines you get is going to be based on how well you do. So if you're a really good communicator, you don't get very many lines. If we think you're rubbish, then you get loads of lines.
Awesome.
I know, it's quite scary.
Don't be nervous. So I'm going to give you your line, okay?
Okay.
And we want you to try to remember your line. If you don't,
more lines.
We might get more lines, yeah. So your line is, I will explain how human society has led to the science line.
Because this is the pivotal moment
yes,
in human society.
Yes, the pivotal moment.
Exactly. Okay, so without any further ado, let's get started with the first segment, which is the Why Do We Care segment. So this is when we give you 2 minutes to explain to us and our listeners what you do as a scientist and why we should care. So no pressure. Good luck.
All right. Well, as a cultural anthropologist, I have been more of a traditional anthropologist in the sense that I work with one indigenous population, primarily the Aleut people in Alaska. They're also called Unangan. They live in the chain of islands that stretches from the Alaska Peninsula all the way to Attu Island, which is at the end of the chain, 1,000 miles stretch of islands. They have been there for 8,000 to 9,000 years, depending on which community we want to go with, which is an incredibly long period of time to be surviving and thriving. And it's really in the most recent era that the villages are dwindling, populations are unstable. There's a lot of consolidation of smaller communities into larger communities. Schools are closing. And so what I do is really tell their story and try to really characterize their circumstances and focus on sustainability. Cultural diversity is really valuable to humanity. So it is, I think, an urgent issue to be supporting these communities and worried about their sustainability. They depend upon volatile resources. So they are mostly fishermen and hunters and gatherers, of course. And these are incredibly volatile. There's also a lot of outside pressure to harvest the fish as well, because there's a lot of money at stake. And so I characterize their relationship to the land, the waters, the economies, and attempt to help preserve that. So I consider myself an applied anthropologist, which means that I use data, I generate data that is aimed at supporting some of their causes. So this can include things like subsistence surveys, so how they use the land and the waters, and what's their footprint, and what do they need to survive from the land. Harvesting and sharing networks. So how do people trade and what are they getting and what's happening within the communities and between the communities? And where are the vulnerabilities? Like, who's in charge and who is unable to get the resources and hunt and fish and do the things that they need to do? They have to have this balance of a cash economy and a subsistence economy. And these things kind of run together as well. And so they're always trying to survive. And so yeah. I'm trying to characterize their situations and give them data so that they can lobby for their own survival.
I'm Risa Ledbetter, here with my co-host, Scott Greaves. Our guest today is Professor Kate Reedy in the Anthropology Department. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation, so stay with us for questions and trivia on the Science Line.
KISU works hard to ensure the reliability of our FM signal, but occasionally, seasonal weather or equipment failures cause us to go off the air. Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org, or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
We want to pause for a moment to let you know that you are listening to The Science Line. I'm Risa Ledbetter, here with my co-host, Scott Greaves. We're now going to jump back into our conversation with Dr. Kate Reedy, an anthropology professor here at Idaho State University. So, Kate, you've been talking about these indigenous peoples in Alaska that you have been working with, and I'm wondering if you can define for us and for our listeners what indigenous peoples are and some of the challenges that might be faced in these communities.
Sure. Indigenous peoples are simply defined as the first peoples on the land and using the resources. And so in the Aleutians, the first peoples, so as the glaciers were receding and the land was becoming usable and visible, the first peoples that populated the Aleutian Islands are the same that are still living there today. So they've been there for thousands and thousands of years. And really what they're doing now is an extension of ancient practices. So they were always hunters and gatherers and fishermen, and they're still doing it. They just have better tools now.
That's pretty interesting. So I wanted to ask you, I bet you've had some fantastic experiences actually traveling to some wonderful places, it sounds like. I wonder if there were any lessons that you got from those experiences that you think perhaps you wouldn't have been able to have if you weren't on the ground and doing this in real life, not just behind a computer screen.
Oh, yes. We call that armchair anthropology. It's frowned upon. You have to be in the field or you are armchair. Worthless. Yeah. So, yeah, the Aleutians have to be experienced. It is an incredibly volatile place. Tectonically, it's always, there's earthquakes daily. Wow. Volcanic eruptions all the time. The wind is phenomenal. It's incredibly stormy. The rhythm of the communities are really attuned to nature. So just to be able to get in and out of a community is weather dependent. Just to be able to move a boat or go get fish or something is weather dependent. And so you have to experience that in order to understand it. It also smells different out there. It just it touches all the senses, I would say. So
are you well received then?
I am. Yes. Yeah. I am well received. Part of that.
That's a very posh question. Let me rephrase it. Do you get on all right when you're there?
I get on just fine. And part of that, I think, we'd have to ask the communities themselves, but part of that is I grew up here in Idaho on a farm, and fishermen and farmers have a lot in common. They're dependent upon the sun and the rain, and the government is always, you know, sticking their fingers in their world. So I think I was instantly comfortable when I went there. They sensed that, and I like hanging out with the old fishermen. I get a lot of joy out of that and their stories. And so I think that helped. I also eventually returned with my kids, and they're very kid-centric. Oh. And one time they told me, don't come back unless you have your kids with you.
Awesome. So you feel like the rapport between you and this community was built fairly readily.
Yeah, I do. I think I was, you know, I was very young and just very open to everything. And I love the food. I'll eat all their food all day.
Like, tell us about the food. Like, what would that be?
Okay.
When you go there?
Okay. Everything. Everything from the sea and on the beach. Oh. And so salmon, crab, my favorite, clams, cod, and then they're shooting birds. Wow. There's caribou. Some islands actually have imported, for food security, they've imported some other land mammals that don't naturally occur there, like buffalo cattle and sheep. Yeah. And so there's some of that roaming around. They're feral now. And so they're not like you'd see here in Idaho. They're pretty wild. So there's just so much to eat. So I think I really stayed for the food.
So I'm wondering, you mentioned, you know, you were kind of young and you were just like, hey, I'm open and I just want to go check these things out. How did you become driven to tell people stories that might not otherwise be told?
Yeah. So when I first, the first village I worked in was called King Cove. And they, at the time I showed up, I had a bunch of research questions that I immediately chucked because there was something else going on. And they were in the middle of a big battle over their salmon fishery with Western Alaska and other indigenous groups. And so morale was really low. They were really struggling in front of the Board of Fisheries to get access to the fish, be able to fish longer periods, use the right equipment, fish longer, a longer season. And what I noticed was that in these meetings where these policies would be decided and what people could do, the groups from Western Alaska, from the Yukon and Kuskokwim area, mostly Yupik and Inupiat communities, they were very upset because their chum and king salmon were not returning to their rivers. They had legitimate complaints here, but they would also advocate for themselves in a very effective way. They really used their identity and used their indigenousness and their place on these rivers as being their right, you know, their birthright and their traditional right for thousands of years. The Aleut communities weren't really doing that. They were advocating more for the commercial side of the fishery. They weren't really mobilizing it as their culture, if that makes sense. So they were saying, yeah, you know, we do this and we do that. And it just sounded like what some of the other white fishermen were doing. But for them, it is very different. And so they really needed was help telling the story a little bit differently so that that indigenous identity came through and that long tradition, thousands of years of being in that particular place. It also helped, I should mention this, I was married at the time to an archaeologist, and he was telling the prehistory of that region as well. And so now they had, not only did they have a cultural anthropologist describing them as really legitimate indigenous peoples, but they had now thousands of years of documentation that they belonged there.
So that's really interesting, because that almost links exactly to what we were talking about at the beginning, because obviously these groups were able to communicate in a certain way that they had been there, but we didn't necessarily recognize it until presented with these documents, right? So that almost demonstrates exactly what we were discussing at the beginning of the show. We need to be better at actually recognizing different means of communication, because obviously our inability to recognize their culture through non-Western means of communication was a limiting factor in our ability to understand how important salmon were to these people. And we actually needed this extra information to come along and back up what they would have already been saying. So that's really interesting. But I am very conscious of the time. So we should continue on to trivia time. On the Science Line, we do like to say that trivia is the true test of how much you actually know. Everything you've said so far is null and void if you can't answer trivia. Okay. Risa, go for the first question. I know you're ready.
All right. Yeah. And it's been fascinating learning about the indigenous group that you have been working with in Alaska. But we're going to sort of take this beyond Alaska. And I want to ask you, what percentage of the world's population comprises indigenous peoples?
Oh, boy. That's a good question. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking linguistically, I might be able to sort of track through my brain.
Okay.
I'm going to say, I know it's low. I'm going to say 6%.
Oh, my goodness. I think I have to give you credit because it's approximately 5%.
Oh, right. Okay. Wonderful.
Scott, she does know something about what she does.
That is very, very good.
And interestingly enough, across 90 countries in the world, there are roughly 370 million indigenous peoples. And this was the thing that got me, is that there's about 4,000 different languages spoken across those groups, which is amazing to think about. Do the indigenous peoples that you're working with in Alaska, do they have their own language or languages?
They do. We think prehistorically there were multiple dialects, and by the time the Russians got involved, they were whittled down to two.
Okay.
So there's two main dialects of the Aleut language. Unfortunately, they're only spoken in a couple of communities. Mm-hmm. Most of the communities have really lost natural communication. They have words and terms and phrases, but
sure.
But sort of everyday chatter is not happening. So,
Wow.
So,
interesting.
So my next trivia question is perhaps not so much trivia, but just more of a question, but we were just really interested, so we just wanted to ask it to you anyway. So, so tribal societies and indigenous communities are sometimes known for putting the community above the individual. So we wondered if you had any personal experience of this and if you could give a specific example.
Yes. So that absolutely characterizes the populations that I work with in Alaska. They are totally community-centric. And one of the ways that I track it is through social networks and the sharing and harvesting and sharing of foods. And what I found is that about 20% of the community is supporting 80% of the community.
Oh. Wow.
Just through sharing networks.
So what do you mean by social network? Obviously, you don't mean Facebook or...
Oh, no. Gosh, no.
Because I can tell by Risa's face, that's what she was thinking. And you can't deny it. You definitely were.
Facebook, Twitter.
No, I mean interactions. So sharing and trading. And this could be all kinds of stuff. It can be labor. It can be childcare. It can be money. And I do track those things a little bit, mostly food and food products. And so 20% on average, it varies between different communities, is supporting 80%.
Wow.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's really, now is it generally like the younger people within the community that are supporting the vast majority of the community?
Yeah, it is. It tends to be the people with the equipment, who has the boat, who has the skiff, who has the four-wheeler. And who's able-bodied, who doesn't have a day job. Sometimes day jobs really interfere with being able to get out.
I mean, it's very similar to our societies in a way, in that you pay into a pension and then in later life you just take from the pension, right? It's sort of that with less of a formal contract.
Okay.
Do you think is that like completely off the track? I feel like it's very similar.
But that's not community-oriented. Is it?
It's as a society, though, isn't it? As a society, we have this social contract that we will pay into a pension scheme or we pay taxes. And then if something happens, that we can take welfare benefit if we need it. Is that
now,
not the same
taxes,
thing?
Taxes, I agree. Taxes are a redistribution. And so it is more It is about the community, right? We don't do this voluntarily, though. We do this. Right. We're compelled.
I think that's kind of the key, right? Is that this is like something that you want to do for your community. And maybe that's the key difference.
You don't want
here.
To pay taxes, Risa. Everyone loves paying taxes. Vote towards a system which then imposes those taxes upon you. So in a way, I mean, I'm not advocating for taxes. I don't love taxes, okay?
We would call this in anthropology, it's a moral economy because people are doing these things through duty.
They're not expecting anything back.
That's right.
I think that's the other thing about this, Scott. I think it's two against one. Our first debate where we have clear sides. We'll see if this one opens a debate.
Hopefully not.
I thought it was great. I was like, Kate, go at him. Get him.
Get him.
I was like, all right, your last question is this. When harvesting honey high up in trees, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, the Seliga people of India not only take some of the honey for themselves, but also leave some for what animal that they consider family?
Oh.
I can give you a hint. If it was a lot smaller, we may try to domesticate it.
Thanks, Scott.
My hints are great.
They're great.
Oh, man. Now I can't remember.
You could think India in particular.
Yeah.
What kind of animal.
Yeah. A tree-dwelling animal.
It's not tree-dwelling,
No,
though.
That's why the people bring the honey down from the trees is because this animal cannot get up into the trees to get the honey for itself.
Okay. So this is probably for a tiger.
Yes, okay. It is a tiger. Man, Scott, she was really good at trivia today.
You did amazingly well.
Yeah, it is the tiger. And as we talked about, tigers can't climb trees and get the honey for themselves. And so this indigenous group gives honey to it. I'm like, how sweet is that?
That is
unless
so
you're a bee,
sweet.
In which case it's really annoying.
Unless you're what?
A bee.
Oh, unless you're a bee. Yeah. Somebody's taking all your honey. Fair enough. You're out for the bees. See, you are causing a debate.
I read this thing today that, it was actually this morning, I was reading about bees, and it was saying that, if you find a bee on the floor and it's in distress, you're supposed to give it a little bit of honey so it can get back up and get going again.
Oh, really?
But then I saw counter-argument was that a bee only produces about 3 grams of honey in its entire life. So if you present a bee with more than 3 grams of honey, not only have you written off that bee's entire life's work, you've actually like just insulted him because you've just shown him more honey than he'll probably ever see in his entire life. So.
Oh, that's great.
Overdose.
Oh, man. Well, one of the last things I want to say about that particular question and note about these indigenous peoples is that they generally have very unique and special relationships and a deep understanding of the animals and the ecosystem around them, which I think is a really, really neat aspect.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I think we should move on to the final bit, which is just the assignment of lines
yep.
to see how well you've done. So what do you reckon?
Well, first, I'm going to ask Kate, do you remember your line? I will explain how human society led to the science line.
Yeah. I blew it.
You blew it. But you did tell us
lines
about
here.
The awesome work that you do. Scott, what's the verdict?
Yeah, well, I think you did really, really well today.
You did.
But I still want to give you the same number of lines as there are people on Earth. So I'm going to give you 7.7 billion lines.
That'll keep you busy for a
that
while.
Seems fair.
Yeah, very fair.
Very fair. All right. Thank you all for joining us on The Science Line today. If you are interested in being on the show, please contact us at thescienceline@isu.edu.